well, let's get started. I don't want to get behind schedule and ready to get started. So, welcome to the Aspen Panic of 2013. And our session today, right here, is Working Situations 1. My name is Richard Sutherland. I'm at the University in Calgary, and I'll be moderating today. We have the speakers. What we will do, I think, is have each presentation and then 10 minutes for questions and then move on to the next one to do it separately. And our first speaker today is Karen Cyrus. Karen is a PhD candidate at York University. Her PhD research explores the career of Donat Roy Jackie Mathieu, musician, producer, and musical director of the recording studio in Jamaica. I think he was also in Toronto at some point.
Yes, he was.
Her other research interests include semiotics, music and social change, music and labor, vocal timbre in Jamaican popular music, contemporary gospel repertoires, steel band, and group piano pedagogy. Karen, it's your show.
Thank you.
Good morning. As Richard said, my interest in the workforce of Jamaican instrumentalists in the 1950s and 60s stem from my research into the life of a Jamaican pianist named Jackie Mathieu. The significance of Mathieu's generation of musicians has been discussed by Lloyd Bradley, Sebastian Clark, David Katz, Norman Stovzoff, Garth White, Clinton Hutton, and Robert Whitmer, among others. Ethnomusicologist Robert Whitmer mentions the achievement of these session musicians and highlights the speed in which they developed ska, rocksteady, and reggae. The short period in which these genres emerged is significant. How was this achieved in such a short time? A survey of scholarly and popular literature on Jamaican popular music reveals two factors, innovation and manpower. This paper uses the narratives of musicians to discuss manpower, the labor market of session musicians within the recording industry in Jamaica from 1957 to 1970. My approach is similar to Jose Vargas Hernandez, who reviews literature to discuss the labor market of musicians in Guadalajara, Mexico. However, Vargas Hernandez focuses on the training and compensation of musicians in competitive labor markets. My focus is on the development of the labor market in the recording industry, its genesis, and factors that led to its demise. First, I will review the social context of life in Kingston leading up to the 1950s. I will then discuss the concept of action sets, which best describes how Jamaican session musicians organize themselves and their terms of employment in response to the needs of the industry and the constraints of society at that time. My main purpose is to add to our knowledge and understanding of the labor market of musicians within the recording industry of a third world country. The historical and social conditions that gave rise to this period are well documented by Brian Moore and Michelle Johnson, Rex Neckford, Gordon Lewis, Nadi Edwards, among others. They consistently identify issues of class as a significant factor in many aspects of Jamaican life, including the consumption and production of music. In their monograph on British cultural imperialism in Jamaica from 1865 to 1920, Moore and Johnson assert that social mobility was achieved through the adaptation of British culture. They state, British-derived cultural attributes and those who came closest to emulating them were accorded the highest social status. Culture, therefore, supplemented race and color in determining one's social position by the late 19th century. The importance of high culture was evident in the names of musical bands. Titles that included orchestra and societies, such as the Eric Dean Orchestra and the Glanville Orchestra, distinguished bands that played for the upper classes from mentor bands that played for the masses. There were also efforts to civilize the island's ethnic majority of Afro-Jamaicans through censored radio programming in the 1950s and to 1970s to support an atmosphere of civilized taste. One outcome of this restricted radio programming in the 1950s was the popularity and growth of sound systems. This was a turntable with large speaker boxes, which was used for outdoor community dances. Sound system gave the poor man access to popular music, specifically rhythm and blues from the United States of America. competition among two leading sound system operators in the 1950s, Clement Dodd and Duke Reed, initiated the earnest local recording of popular music to fulfill the demand of new music for these dances. Dodd started recording local singers as early as 1956 and Reed in 1958. Recording locally produced music provided job opportunities for musicians. However, deeply entrenched social constraints of class and color affected musicians in a number of ways. Musicians who were employed in orchestras and society bands, such as guitarist Ernest Ranglin, report that they had to hide their association with the recording studios to keep their jobs. Ranglin states that he remained anonymous for fear of reprisal. He says, "I didn't want to front it. It was ghetto music, and in Jamaica, they used to put that music down. This music was rebel music even then, the way society looked at it and at themselves. They treated it as if it was against the idea of society. It was like we were the outcasts who played that music. There were so many tunes I was responsible for, but I didn't go in front of them because I also had to be playing up at the society functions and the hotel dances. And there they would be looking down on me. Maybe I wouldn't get enough work. You had to walk the line." Ranglin remained anonymous out of fear. However, musicians who maintained a high profile and were not bashful about working with ghetto music were documented and recognized. Others remained anonymous. Description of the workforce. My research shows that from 1957 to 1970, there were at least 150 men that worked occasionally in the Jamaican popular music recording industry. Their labor may be described as skilled and unskilled, trained and untrained. There were apprentices, internships, and situations of informal professional development called jam sessions. Based on the discourse on Jamaican popular music, there were two types of session bands. I will refer to one as a stable in-house band and the other as an action set band. A stable studio band consisted of musicians who were employed to the record producer as permanent or contracted staff. This was similar to the terms of employment in society bands. When Dodd opened Studio One in 1961, his intention was to have a stable in-house session band. This is evident in Lloyd Bradley's description of the terms of employment at Studio One. He says, "Dodd took the unprecedented step of putting a nucleus of the island's best musicians on wages, rather than hiring them as and when and paying them per side cut. His reasoning was that this would allow the players the chance to explore and be genuinely creative, and then to make sure they got it right. It's an indication of exactly what such an opportunity meant, that in spite of his wages being pitifully low, many of the best bandsmen in Jamaica took him up on his offer. Of course, Dodd was buying their time, not their exclusivity, so they supplemented their income by working elsewhere." Bradley mentions two types of employment in this quote, as and when, which is casual work, and hiring musician as permanent staff, which is unusual as the more prevalent type of work mentioned in Jamaican popular music discourse was casual labor. I will use the concept of an action set to describe how musicians as casual workers were brought together for a specific recording or a day's work. Action sets. The concept of an action set is used by Adrian Mayers, an anthropologist, to describe how tasks are successively achieved through personal networks within an informal environment, as opposed to tasks that are completed by a permanent group. Terms related to action sets include egos, brokers, patrons, and cores. The person who wants a task completed is the ego. The ego selects persons from a group of potential workers to complete the task. The person selected to complete a task is an action set. The action set is not a permanent entity like a group. The workers are not permanently employed. They are called on a case-by-case basis as needed, which is the definition of casual labor. Mayers describes action set as ego-centered, depending for their very existence on a specific person as a central organizing focus. Action sets can also evolve. Mayer found that persons who are called repeatedly to form successive action sets may become a clique or a core. A core is simply two or more persons who prefer to work together. A core may evolve into a central ego or a formal group. A formal group ceases to be an action set. In the context of Jamaican popular music, the record producer was usually the ego, and the task was recording a song. The action set comprised of musicians hired to play for a recording session. In the discourse on Jamaican popular music, action sets are implied in the working relationships between instrumentalists and the producer. This is demonstrated in the way Colin Larkin describes the aggravators. This was the name given by Jamaican producer Bunny Lee to any gatherings of session musicians he happened to be using at any given time. Lee Perry's studio band, The Upsetters, also provide an example of this. Chuck Foster describes the band as an open-ended, loose-knit group. Larkin uses similar terms to describe the band. The Upsetters were the collective tag for whatever group reggae producer Lee Perry had in his studio at the time of recording or for his sporadic live dates. Only the name of the band, the collective tag, The Upsetters, was permanent. The expressions "any gathering of musicians" and "whatever group of musicians" indicate that the musicians in the band were selected on a case-by-case basis. Recruitment. Action sets are implied in the way musicians were recruited for work. Being called is a term that is most frequently used in discourse to describe how musicians were recruited. A call signifies an invitation to join an action set. Skilled and trained musicians were approached first to join action set bands. They were called first calls. They were preferred for their ability to quickly realize the musical ideas of producers and singers and to record in one take. This is evident in Ernest Ranglin's account of life as a musician in Kingston. Ernest Ranglin states, "We just felt like we were doing a job back then. If a man asked you to come down to the studio and here's $2 or $10 to play a song, you did it. We were musicians and we just wanted to play the next chorus right, play the next phrase to make the singers and the producers happy. Then they'll use you again." The real excitement for us as working musicians was that a man was going to pay us. Based on this account, musicians were paid per song, and this work in recording studios, the work was a gig or a day's work. The jobs were not permanent. He also mentions getting a call back. They'll use you again. That is, a job well done may result in a future first call. Lynn Tate, a significant figure in Jamaican popular music, also mentions that he was called for work in his description of a workday. He says, "They may call me for a session at 9 a.m. in the morning until 12 noon, and another session would start at 1 and finish at 4, with another one at 5 until 8 at night. So maybe 4 or 5 sessions a day for different promoters." That's how it used to be at that time. Of course, novice new musicians who were not first calls found work in another way. Leroy Horsemouth Wallace reveals in an interview that some musicians in the early 1960s would go to recording studios and wait for the opportunity to substitute first calls, musicians who did not turn up for a recording. He names Orange Street, which is Duke Reed's Treasure Isles, as the place to find work as a musician. The musicians who hung out at the studios looking for work were not first calls. Monikers of session bands. Another sign of an action set studio band resides in the name of the band, the moniker of the band. Session bands that have the appendage All Stars with the producer or studio name, such as Brentford All Stars and Prince Buster's All Stars, are likely to be monikers for action set session bands. Musicians who were not afraid to associate with the recording industry would use their own names as monikers for action set session bands. The leader for the studio band that recorded the first rocksteady hit, Take It Easy, was Trinidadian Lynn Tate. At Federal Studio, Tate named his band Lynn Tate and the Jets. This differed from the previous trends where the studio band was given the name of the producer or the studio. Tate explains the system for choosing a musician's moniker for an action set. He says, "Whoever would have a tune would get the credit and more money. Usually Barbara Brooks led the session, so a tune would be by his group, unless it was my tune like Magnificent. If it's Drumbaga's All Stars, that means it was Drumbaga's tune, and so forth. Therefore, if four musicians practice six songs together in the same session, there was a possibility that each song could be published in one of four different group names. Each tune would be credited to the moniker of the musician that brought the tune to the session. Tate's approach was a clever strategy that studio musicians use to assert ownership over their intellectual property. However, as aforementioned, some musicians seemed willing to give up their rights to the producers, such as Wranglin, who admits that he gave up his rights because of social constraints. Tate, who was not Jamaican, was among those musicians who did not have this fear. Another type of action set moniker was practiced by producer Herman Lin Choi of Aquarius Label, who hired keyboard players and gave them all the same name. This practice is elaborated in Chin Loy's biography on allmusic.com. So this has been mixed up. This is actually a list of many of the monikers of session bands. What you have here is the name of the band. And this is just the name, as I said. These are the producers, and this is the other first recording. So as I said, all of these names were just hollow. They meant that whenever Lloyd Bailey wanted to record something, he would bring musicians and they will become magical all-stars. So I was talking about the action, another type of action set moniker. This is really, I found really interesting. Herman Chin Loy, as I said, of Aquarius Label, who hired keyboard players and gave them all the same name. This practice is elaborated in Chin Loy's biography on allmusic.com. Chin Loy had been releasing instrumentals, mainly organ-led affairs by Upsetter acolyte Glenn Adams, and credited them to an invented name, Augustus Pablo. So when the person we know as Augustus Pablo, which was Horace Swaby, arrived on the scene, Chin Loy saw no reason to change the credit, and so Horace Swaby became Augustus Pablo. Based on Mayer's model, the next stage of development from an action set is the formation of cliques or corps. This was also evident in Jamaican popular music discourse. One type of corps was based on kinship, such as the Barrett brothers, who played for the Wailers. Another type of corps was simply based on camaraderie, such as Sly and Robbie. Moskowitz's description of the Revolutionaries presents a clear example of how action sets with corps are represented in Jamaican popular music discourse. In the mid-70s, the Revolutionaries was the group that Hukim used when he needed a backing band in the studio. In addition to Sly and Robbie, the band consisted of a host of other players other than Sly and Robbie. These members came and went and were not employed unless specifically called for. Musicians who formed corps would move from one group to another together. Many corps eventually formed stable show bands, like the orchestras, or became producers together, such as Steely and Cleavey and Sly and Robbie. Advantages of action sets. Musicians may have preferred action sets because of the low rates of pay across the industry. In an interview, Clement Dodd states that musicians were employed to him, but he sympathetically overlooked the musician's breach of contract in recognition of the fact that his main competitor, Duke Reed, paid a higher fee. Katz reports that Coxon was powerless to stop Reed from offering better money to these musicians. He says, whatever it costs, Duke would find the money. Even if I had a contracted artist, Duke would still insist and use them. After a while, you realize the man is a musician and that's the only way he could really earn. So you let him play. Although an employment contract implies more consistent work than an action set, musicians were not satisfied with the pay. Action sets allowed instrumentalists to seek work wherever it was offered and maximize the amount of money they could make. conflict of interest did not seem to be an issue. Action Sets created a loose framework that enabled new investors, producers to enter the industry, which is evident in the prevalence of All-Stars bands. This created a larger workforce than a situation where musicians only played with one band. More producers resulted in the recording of more songs and more work for the musicians. Things fall apart. Robert Dirks discusses the way in which personal networks and groups are used to make the most of scarce resources. Dirks asserts if participation in network systems such as Action Sets were invariably favored over participation in banded groups would disappear. The converse is also true. In the case of Jamaican popular music, Action Sets might have remained the dominant type of studio band if men were compensated fairly. However, musicians invariably mentioned that they were exploited. Therefore, although Action Sets was an efficient use of manpower, producers used the system to exploit musicians in a number of ways. Davis explains how musicians were oppressed. He says, musicians were completely dependent on the goodwill of their producer. There were no contracts, royalties, residuals, or any of the other usual guarantees. In the Jamaican music industry, the producer was the star and took credit for the recordings, not the musicians. As a result, producers in Jamaica and abroad were to become wealthy, while their artists and musicians would, in many instances, continue to suffer in poverty and degradation. The use of monikers without giving credit to the musicians stripped musicians of their intellectual property and rights. Remaining anonymous may have suited some musicians who were concerned about social status. However, it backfired. Other types of mistreatment would also go unchecked because they were casual workers. If they complained, they were simply not called again. Musicians who were able abandoned studio work to look for more lucrative opportunities on the international market. A number of musicians went on international tours with superstars such as Desmond Dekker, Tootsie Mettle, Jimmy Cliff, and Bob Marley. A number of other musicians migrated to find work among the Jamaican diaspora in the UK and Canada. The advent of computer and Casio synthesizers automated the work of musicians, as producers reused and recycled instrumental tracks instead of hiring musicians. This led to what Bradley calls the reggae karaoke phase. The evolution of Jamaican popular music continued, but the instrumentalists were no longer the creative force or support for singers. It is well documented how innovations in Jamaican popular music continued in its vocal expression. As a result, many more skilled and trained musicians found work with singers who toured internationally. Some went back to work in stable bands in the hotel circuit. Some formed show bands and others became producers. Summary. The following conditions supported the productivity of the Jamaican popular music workforce. One, there was a ready supply of trained and skilled workers at the start of the recording industry. Two, remuneration for labor encouraged musicians to enter the profession. Three, there was manpower to support a busy recording schedule through Action Sets, which was necessary to meet the large demand for recording sessions from an increasing number of producers. Four, the ongoing training of musicians, both formal and informal, supported the workforce. Access to training allowed those interested to enter the industry. This ensured a steady supply of manpower, creative energy, and helped to tap the creative potential of novices. The quality of music that is required to create a genre is either created by a small group of bands over a long period of time or by a large number of bands in a short period of time. The evolution of Jamaican popular music was achieved in a relatively short time, from ska to reggae. Based on Jamaican popular music discourse, the organizational system that facilitated this was Action Sets. This created a loose framework which distributed labor among a number of producers. As the labor market matured, musicians formed cores or cliques, which contracted the loose framework that allowed the system to work. Mass attrition due to frustration because of unfair practices toward workers, including the automation of their jobs, resulted in the demise of the system. In addition to the points I stated above, what I have learned is that a system of casual labor, such as Action Set, if managed properly, can advance the music industry. Thank you.
Okay, so we'll have to questions.
It's a great paper. It would be interesting to see how quickly things happen.
I'm fascinated with me, and I don't have a lot of expertise in radio, but I do have a teacher. So, to me, there is a pretty consistent sound in the form of some of the stuff that we do to be sound kind of different from radio. I wonder if you had any insight to that. I could be just not.
Well, when you refer to sound, are you talking about the singing or the music itself?
I'm talking about the instrumental tracks, because the mood is pretty consistent a lot of the time. I'm ready to believe that a lot of the same musicians are working on a lot of the same recordings.
What has happened? This paper was taken from my comprehensives. And what I had said before was that there were two things, innovation and manpower. In terms of innovation, how the workforce worked was that even though you had a set of musicians, very, very trained ones, what you had was a lot of novice musicians, and they worked along with one or two of them at the same time. So the fact, the saying, what I have found, and based on the discourse, is that the thing where they said that it was only like 20 moving from one, it's not really true. There were over 150 of them, and they kind of separated and came together. But you will find, if you listen closely to ska, rock steady, and reggae, that there are differences in the three genres. I don't have the music here to demonstrate. I'm sorry, but what you will find is, of course, with ska, especially between ska and rock steady, in 1966, you had technological advances. So what you'll find with ska, apart from that distinctive ska beat, the instruments were also different, because ska used an acoustic bass, which sounds totally different from an electronic bass. The acoustic bass in ska would have more walking basses, while the electronic bass had a more repetitive, more repeated notes. That came from developments in the instruments, of course, the invention of the electric bass. Also, it came out because we had a novice musician, Leroy Sibley, who was now playing in studio. And this, when I say novice, you know, this guy did not play the bass before. And the director at this time said, you know what, I think you can play the bass, play this. And he started to play in the way that he could. And that's what happened, and then they built around that sound. And that's why I said, in the paper, the trained musicians facilitated and helped the novice musicians. So what you found was a collaboration, and I found existence of auxiliary roles. So you might have one person just doing one thing in the recording, just making one sound, and the others help him to create a sound. For that reason, for me, it sounds different. Each one sounds distinct, because I'm listening to the timbre, I'm listening to the types of instruments, I'm listening to the type of bass line, which is distinct in each one. I hope that helped.
Absolutely.
Okay.
I'm just with one more brief question, and then we start a little bit late.
Yes.
I'm wondering if you can tell me a little bit about the connections that people would have had informally with friends and family in particular, and how that might have affected who got what jobs. So I was thinking that it sounds like that was probably something that was going on.
Definitely. A very important part of action sets, if you research Adrian Mayer's work. And now, this is something that has been written in the 1960s, and, you know, he has been challenged by other writers. So I've gone back to something that is pretty old. But one of the important things of action set is personal networks. You know, you get in contact with people based on who you know. So, of course, there were links. A lot of the musicians were actually neighbors. They lived beside each other. As I showed you, some of the musicians were brothers. You have families that most of the boys, and there were only boys, sorry, men, were involved in the music industry. And you know what? Boys, because they started pretty young. They started at 12 to 15. So yes, I will not correct myself. So there were a lot of families. They lived beside each other, and so you did have connections. There was also networking. As I mentioned here, jam sessions. Now, jam sessions occurred we think about jazz and we think about cutting sessions, right? Jazz sessions occurred in a different way. You had Rastafarian campsites. The Rastafarians, who were kind of at the bottom of the social ladder, had a strong musical tradition. And musicians would meet there. Some of them would live on site and kind of, you know, got techniques from indigenous traditional drumming practices. And so you had networking that could expand in that way. I hope that helped.
Well, thanks very much. A fascinating paper.
Thank you.
To talk to you about it myself afterwards. So thank you again.
Thank you.